I am your solo host today, Monica Hadley. And our guest today is Parisa Akbari. And she is she's a writer and mental health therapist from Seattle, Washington. When not writing or therapizing, I didn't even know that was a word, therapizing. She can be found trying to replicate her grandmother's drool-worthy Persian recipes, hanging out with the disability community, and marathoning sci-fi movies with her partner and dogs. Just Another Epic Love Poem is her debut novel. And I would say this is a YA novel, young adult novel, although it certainly could be read of any age because we're all young adults at heart, aren't we?
Yes.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, Parisa.
Thanks for having me, Monica.
So give us kind of an overview of what this book is.
Just Another Epic Love Poem picks up at senior year for the main character, Mitra, after she has moved to a Catholic school for 5 years and been in this environment where she feels pretty confined and pretty isolated. And the one person that she has connected to and who has become her best friend in her world is B. And the two of them have bonded over their love of poetry. So they've been writing this epic poem back and forth between the two of them over the course of those 5 years. And they have rules for the poem that it can't have any terminal punctuation. So no periods, no exclamation points, question marks. And they also pick up on the word that the last person ended on. So it has this sort of endless quality between the two of them. And as senior year is unfolding and as Mitra and B are looking ahead to their futures, Mitra is recognizing that she's fallen in love with B. And she doesn't know what to do with that. And so the book gets to follow the story of how Mitra and B's relationship changes, how the poem changes, and how their lives change as they fall in love and as they prepare to head out into the world, and as other family dynamics and family relationships change around them.
I was going to say, you know, you do throw kind of a lot of issues at Mitra. In terms of, that she has to deal with. So, you know, there is the fact that she is bi in a Catholic school. She is from an immigrant family, which is can have its own challenges in America today. And she is non-Catholic in a Catholic school.
Yeah.
And she has... And her mother is a recovering addict, and her relationship with her mother is fraught because of the harm that was caused by her addiction.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, why give her so much to have to deal with? Wouldn't just one of those things be enough?
I mean, it does sound like a lot when you lay it all out there, but I think that's true to life. And I think it's true to the intersectional experiences of young people who feel like they've been pushed to the margins or made into outsiders in some way, that they're both dealing with the way that their identities clash with the dominant culture around them, and also kind of the regular teen stuff of falling in love and navigating changing relationships with parents. And so for Mitra, just existing as Iranian American and queer in her environment is enough to feel like she's constantly battling and struggling and having to contain a part of herself and stay kind of under the radar in order to stay safe and sane in her environment. And then at the same time, she's also dealing with some of the normal issues that teens go through. First love and figuring out what it means to trust or to build a relationship. So it's kind of that combination of the unique nuances of someone on the outskirts of our culture that isn't really embraced and accepted fully for who they are, who's also just trying to stay afloat
And of course, there's the whole, what am I going to do with the rest of my life that you're facing as a senior in high school?
Yeah.
That in which in and of itself is can be extremely stressful. And, yeah. You know, when we're past that point, you know, decades past that point, it's a good reminder. A book like this is a good reminder of what that feels like, you know, to be, you have your whole life ahead of you. How do you know what direction to go in?
Yeah. The idea that there are so many possible doors and so many possible roads ahead of you, but every time you choose one door to walk through, it can feel like all the others are closing, and that one choice is also a choice to eliminate all these other possible futures. That can feel really daunting when you're a young person to say, okay, if I'm going to this school, it means I'm not going to that school. If I pursue being in this career or this major, it means I'm not going to pursue this other dream that I had for myself. If I choose to, you know, form a relationship with my best friend romantically, it means that we're not going to be best friends in the same way that we were. So every choice seems like it comes with all of these repercussions, and that can feel intimidating.
It sure does. I've often thought, you know, looking at various friends and family members, sometimes that people who have a lot of different talents sometimes struggle more to find their place in the world for that very reason, that it's harder. If there's only one thing that you really love and are good at, then making the decision about what to do isn't that hard. But if there's a lot of things that you love and are good at, I've known people who just, they can't stick to one thing long enough to actually be successful at it, because there's always something else that seems like it might be better for them.
Yeah. And I think too, at least from the perspective of Mitra, a part of it is this fear of change. And so if you do commit to one thing, what are you letting go of or losing in that process? If you do open up to one possibility or step through one door, what is it that could come back to bite you? So in her relationship with her mom, who she's been disconnected from for almost 5 years, she's debating, you know, is it worthwhile to accept this extended hand from her to reconnect and to try to repair the relationship? And if she does take that step, what is she inviting into her life? What can happen as a result? So that fear of committing to one thing or choosing one thing, I think for her at least, can really come from this sense that anything could be taken away at any point, and it's better not to even try to hold on to something if you know that you could lose it.
She's fortunate, though, that her father is such a grown-up and not, you know, I think a lot of times in a family situation like that, the parent who stayed and raised the kids might have a lot of resentment towards the one who left or the one who was incapable of doing, of being a parent. And, and yet her father really, is very forgiving but also doesn't force her into having a relationship with her mother. Lets it be Mitra's choice about what to do. Do you find, you know, I don't know if you deal, you know, what kind of therapy that you do and whether this is something that you've seen in your practice, but it just, do you think there are dads or moms out there who are that mature and grown up and could handle it that way?
Yeah. You know, I'm primarily work with adolescents, and I have worked with parents in that role as well. And absolutely. I think that some of the greatest resources for young people can be parents who provide the structure and support and love, but also say, this is your life and your decision. And at that age, it's really hard oftentimes for parents to start relinquishing control and to say that they have to kind of unclench a little bit from the driver's seat of their child's life, but to say, okay, if you're 17, 18, pretty soon these decisions are going to be solely yours, and you want them to feel prepared for that and to be able to weigh the pros and cons and do the critical thinking on their own. I think for Mitra's dad, the way that I envisioned him was that for him, he's had almost 5 years living independently with his daughters and forming this really stable, loving home with them. And on the one hand, his logical mind is saying his former wife is doing really well. His kid's mother has gone through treatment and rehab and seems to be stable, and she's shown that she's really far in recovery. Logically, he knows that she has a place in their life if they want her. And then from the emotional side, I think he's both feeling some unease about the possibility of the dynamic at home changing with his daughters, losing time with them, losing even maybe some of the influence that he has as a single parent, as opposed to having the idea of co-parenting. And he's also recognizing how painful it might have been if he could imagine himself in her shoes and to not know his girls for 5 years, to not be in their lives, to not watch them grow. That I think for him is a driver in saying, okay, at the end of the day, even if he doesn't like it, she has a right to be in their lives if she's doing well.
Right. So I'm sure that you've been asked this before, but how much of you is Mitra? Or how much is Mitra you?
You know, for this story, I really wanted to draw from real emotions. So the emotions of longing and fear and, you know, the experience of wondering if vulnerability is worthwhile and is connection worthwhile. So in that way, I drew from some true emotional experiences that I could relate to as a teen. Mitra's story is not my story. And her personality, I think, is also pretty different from mine, at least at that age. I wasn't out in high school. I did go to a Catholic school, but I took a different journey than Mitra. And I had a great friend group, and I had, you know, a really just different dynamic and different experience than she had. But looking at the set of circumstances that I grew up in, I could imagine a character like her having a different experience than I had. So I both wanted to connect to these real emotions and also some of the bits of my own identity, but to mix it in a different way that looked different from what I went through at that age.
Now, I'm curious about going to a Catholic school. Is the family Muslim, or do they have a real?
Her dad is raised Muslim in Iran, and her mom was raised Zoroastrian, which is sort of the Persian faith that predates some of the more recent monotheistic religions there. And so they have these cultural and spiritual backgrounds that play a part in Mitra and her sister Azar's lives, but they don't have the sort of firm rules or doctrine that she encounters in Catholic school.
So why would they choose to send her to a Catholic school? Is that, and you said you went to a Catholic school, I'm guessing your family was also not Catholic?
Yeah, not Catholic.
So why and what is that like?
Yeah, so oftentimes religiously funded private schools can be more affordable than secular private schools, but still the potential of having a private school education and some of the high quality education you can get there. And so I think for a lot of immigrant parents, there's this appeal of having, you know, the opportunity to give your child a private school education that's also affordable and subsidized by the church. And so that was my experience. And I had plenty of friends in my Catholic high school who were from immigrants from, you know, countries like the Philippines or Mexico or other places where there was some Catholic history in that country. Mm-hmm. And so it made sense for their families to attend. But for me, I think my parents just thought, here's a really good school that we can afford both you and your sister to attend. That was their perspective. And it was definitely a place where I felt like an outsider, even though I was a social kid and really, you know, connected with friends and peers. And I was very engrossed in school, interested in learning. I also got those messages day in and day out, like Mitra gets, about who is worth saving and who's worthwhile and what is holy and unholy and what happens to people who don't share the same beliefs or whose identities are, you know, diverging from heterosexuality. And so that was a difficult environment to kind of try to form my own identity in, because I started Catholic school in kindergarten. And wow. I stayed through my junior until my end of my sophomore year of high school.
Wow. You know, we did a book recently. The title was Once We Were Home, and it was about Jewish children who were sent to live in Christian and Catholic families, or sometimes convents or monasteries during the Holocaust, and, you know, to save their lives. And then what happens to them afterwards, you know, once the war was over. And it kind of reminds me of this, because in some cases the children were very, you know, they were getting these messages that, you know, their parents weren't saved because they weren't Christian, and it was could be very confusing for the child.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially when you're so young, if you're 5 or 6 and your friends are putting on those frilly white dresses and having their first communions, and you see all of these rituals that feel kind of dazzling and mystical, and you're thinking, why am I not a part of that? And what does the church say that it means that I'm not a part of that? Mm. And what does it say about my family? And it was complicated, especially because I was coming of age in the era of 9/11. I was in middle school during 9/11. And so that added its own layers of complexity around my like religious and cultural background within the school. So it was definitely a unique experience.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Parisa Akbari, author of Just Another Epic Love Poem. What made you decide to write this story based around this ongoing poem that the two characters are writing back and forth to one another?
When I think about the way that my friends and I communicated in high school, I often think about the streams of different modes of communication that we shared. So this was a little while ago, but we had texting at the time, and we had, you know, nonstop text messages going back and forth. We did a lot of handwritten notes. So we would pass notes in class or between classes, or write each other letters about, oh my gosh, I have to tell you everything that happened between me and this guy on our date last night. And you would put it in someone's locker. And then you would have these endless phone calls at night with your sister saying, get off the phone. Those kinds of like nonstop, never ending conversations where it felt like you had 5 minutes together between classes and then you part ways, but you knew that the conversation would continue. And I thought about how to take that ebb and flow and turn it into something that could work in the text of a sort of literary fiction like this book. And I thought that the poem could be a great thread for these two friends, because in a way, they use their words to form this skeleton around which they get to tell their truths and be honest about their experiences in a place where they feel like they can't speak their truths. So they're in this school where they feel not accepted for the most part, but then they have this book that they can share that they see as this sacred spiritual thing. And it's the place where they feel safe together and they can really see each other.
I love how you, how their poetry workshop teacher comes to be very supportive, which is a big surprise to Mitra. She wasn't expecting that. And did you have a teacher like that?
I did. Yeah. I drew from several teachers who had a great influence on me when I was writing the poetry seminar teacher, Ms. Acosta. I had a few teachers who I felt like set aside some of the mainstream values that we were absorbing in school and really saw me as an individual and would see that I'm somebody who is worthwhile and who has something to offer, they saw that I had this curiosity for learning and for spirituality, even though it was maybe outside the framework that they were used to operating under. And they also really encouraged me and nurtured me in a way that made me feel like this isn't them saying, oh, but you're not Catholic, but let's see what we can do to kind of fix you or save you. It was more like, oh, I really see who you are. And maybe this isn't a place that is going to see you, but I see you and I will do what I can to show you that you matter.
In today's environment, a book like this, Just Another Epic Love Poem, about a love story between two girls, is likely to get banned in some places. Did you think about that as you were writing and getting ready to publish?
I can't imagine a book that I could write
that wouldn't get banned.
That wouldn't, yeah. You know where I'm going with this. Yeah. I think that just existing in a politicized identity, like being Iranian American, being queer, being disabled, the stories that I'm going to tell are going to capture the nuances of those identities. And those will always be perceived as political, even when there's no political tone to what I'm writing. Mitra and B aren't really, I don't think they would see themselves as activists or anything. And not that they're, I think they could find their way to that in college, but in where they are in high school, they're really just focused on their love of poetry, their relationships, their family dramas. They, you know, I don't think they have the awareness of how all of this connects to some of the larger political themes, but I think that will always be perceived as political to make space for queer romance, to comment on some of the issues within a system like Catholicism, to tell a love story between two characters of color who are immigrants, children of immigrants. I think that will always be perceived in that light. And so I expect that everything I write will be.
It's not fair.
Yeah.
It's not fair. You know,
however, I do think there's such a robust support for banned books that is really special, that as hard as some folks are fighting to remove books from kids' schools and libraries, there are other, you know, radical librarians out there who are really advocating for and fighting to include these books and to make them available to the right kids. And so as much as it's disheartening and it's scary for me to think about the level of censorship that some kids are experiencing, I think there will always be folks who are fighting just as hard to create access. And I am hopeful for that.
Were there any books that you read in that age, in high school, that made you feel like you were seen?
Hmm. You know, the books that I read at that age, for the most part, were centered around white heterosexual stories. And I still would really connect to the characters and their experiences, but I didn't see myself reflected. And it wasn't until I started to stumble upon some of the queer Iranian American authors that are writing today, like Sarah Farizan and Adib Khoram and others, that I started to see, oh, wow, people are telling the stories that I want to tell. And people are writing about these nuances in Persian culture that I experienced and I grew up with. So that came to me more in early adulthood. But I do remember one book in particular that my mom bought me just on a lark. She was at a bookstore and there happened to be a reading and a signing with, I think, a local author. And she didn't know, my mom didn't know what the book was about, but it was called something with girl in the title. And so she thought, my daughter will like this. And she bought it and had the author sign it. And I remember toward the end of the novel, there was some hint that the main character, who was a girl, was having a crush on this girl on her basketball team. And I remember like reading that page over and over again and being like, I think I'm detecting something here, that they're implying that these two girls have feelings for each other. And I felt like it blew my mind, that I thought like, this was on purpose. Somebody put this in this book on purpose. And I, you know, my mom didn't know this was in the book. What would she have said if she did? And just sitting there with that page and really feeling like, even though I couldn't articulate at the time that I would end up identifying as queer, I just felt like it blew my mind.
I think that it's fortunate that you can be a little more direct now, not quite so subtle, even though, you know, like we said, there may be some pushback from some areas. But there's kids out there who need this, who need to see this. Now, is the Iranian culture in general accepting of queer identity or not? Or can you not even generalize?
I think it's hard to generalize, because that's kind of like if we ask if the American culture is accepting. On the one hand, we can look at the laws and, you know, same-sex marriage being legalized. But on the other hand, you could say, well, there's absolutely groups of people who are advocating really hard to strip folks of their rights.
Right.
So I think what I can say is Iran, as a country, has a long way to go, and homosexuality is still a crime that is punishable by death.
Oh my.
And at the same time, there are such strong and connected communities of queer folks and trans folks, both in and out of Iran. And I think that there's this unique interweaving between the artistic and poetic legacies of Iran, which are very fluid and romantic and expressive and evocative, with the concept of queerness. So in my experience, a lot of people in the Iranian diaspora have been very accepting of queerness to me. And I think that has to do with the sort of rich legacy of culture around art and theater and music, and how that tends to draw people who are a little bit different, a little bit more expressive, maybe existing on the outside or on the outskirts in some way. So I think there's a special place within the Iranian community, Iranian American and Iranian diaspora community, for queer and trans folks.
You know, I remember reading somewhere, and I'm not sure if it was a book or about, and I'm not sure if it was Iran, but somewhere in the Middle East, where there was actually a acceptance of trans people where they would actually allow them to have the surgery and everything. And can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah. If you look at the writing of Sarah Farizan. Her debut novel was called If You Could Be Mine, and it explores that topic. And it's the story of a young Iranian girl who's in love with her best friend. And Iran,
that was it. Yep.
Yeah. The perspective is that being trans in Iran is seen as a medical condition that can be treated through, you know, gender affirming surgery and other treatments. And that is accepted in that way. This is at least my understanding as an outsider, that that's what I have heard about the community, but that homosexuality is viewed as a sin. And so it's very interesting to think about what then becomes available to people within those constraints, and what sort of underground communities form, and how people try to thrive within a system that is really, you know, complex in the way that it addresses their identities.
Yeah, that's so, in a way, surprising, because I'd say in the U.S. there's certain segment of the population who is very unaccepting of anything from the accepted norm.
Yeah.
Put them over on one side. There's another, of course, that are completely open-minded. But there are some people who seem to be, you know, okay with homosexuality, but not with trans. But I don't see it the other way.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's an example of how much our idea of what's normal is a cultural construct, right? Because in one country, there's this attitude that being trans is perceived in this way. And in another country, the attitude can be totally different. And so it really comes down to, how do we as a culture define gender and sexuality, and what are the values that we impose? And then what do we do to people who exist outside of those defined boundaries or values? Yeah.
Wow. Well, Patricia, would you like to read a little bit from Just Another Epic Love Poem?
I'd love to. So I will read a chapter that is called Confession. It is toward the beginning of the book, as Mitra is processing why she feels like she cannot express her love for her best friend, and why she feels like she needs to keep that a secret, despite the fact that they share everything in this poem that they write back and forth. Loving B isn't a choice. Love is the reflex to be existing at all. Like squinting at the sun or shivering when she touches the back of my neck. My body just knows to do it. I can't control a reflex, and that petrifies me. In the past, B was off limits. She's always had some kind of romantic possibility in the works. There was Kara, and before Kara, there was Harper. And before Harper, there was Natalie, whom she sort of dated at the same time as Harper. B attracts romantic entanglements like cat hair to a lint roller. She can't help it. It's just how she is. And because she was always taken, I could seal her off behind a brick wall of best friend in my mind. I made watertight boundaries. But now that she's single, all my feelings are starting to leak through. If I had to pinpoint a beginning, it's this. The summer after sophomore year, B came over for one of our marathon nights of chatter and reading and snacks, which she'd just started calling wakeovers because we were terrible at remembering to sleep. Around 11, B pointed out my bedroom window. Up for stargazing? The window formed a perfect portal to a flat section of the rooftop. We'd only ever gone out there for daytime sun soaking, but it was a gorgeous night, and B put on her begging eyes. We dragged blankets, books, and a thermos of chai through the mouth of the window and made a nest on the rooftop. The June air filled my nose with earthy after-storm smells. Bee in the blanket was soft and cozy, and the night around us sighed with breeze. The darkness gave me permission to ask Bee the questions that had camped in the back of my brain since we were 13. Why did you single me out that first day? I homed in on her face. Bee's curls expanded in proportion to how late we stayed up. The tip of her nose flushed warm from the chai, and her chestnut eyes lit with the glow from my bedroom lamp. I could have been literally anyone, I said. You don't know what you were getting into. You looked like a reader, she shrugged, like it was so easy for her to choose me. That first choice catalyzed a thousand others, and there we were, still bobbing in the ripple of her paper scrap. I thought, her eyes tracked mine. I guess I thought we'd understand each other. And we did. She reached into the blanket tangle and brandished the book. It was our first one, with a tattered black cover and red ribbon bookmark. Thought we could read some together. She shed her glasses and brought her face close to our 13-year-old handwriting. I expected her to cringe at our dorky rhymes, but instead she smiled this private smile and huddled closer to me in the blankets. I leaned into her side and rested my head on her shoulder while she read, my cheek nuzzled into her collarbone. Maybe I was the only person who got to see this bee, the wee hour bee, starry and bound up in wonder. Look at us, she said. When she read the passages to me, her mouth carried everything, all the awkwardness, all the treasures. Her voice wrapped around me. In that moment, I knew it. I loved bee. And not in the way I should have loved her, if she were only my best friend. This was a whole new layer of feeling, like that night had stripped the haze off everything around me. And swirled up in the rich dark of that night, loving her felt possible, like I'd found some way to stretch beyond friendship and reach something deeper, like maybe, just maybe she could love me too. But then she put the book down and started analyzing a 30-second conversation she'd had with the popcorn girl at the Crossroads movie theater who she'd always suspected was gay. I think there's something there, she said. You know, maybe I should go for it. And just like that, the possibility burned away. When we crawled back into my room, evidence of our friendship was everywhere. Pictures of us with Azar in our uniforms on the last day of school. Ticket stubs from our trip to the butterfly exhibit. A tragically ugly teacup we made at Paint the Town. Panic iced up my spine. Bee was everything to me. Without her, I'd have no one. I couldn't gamble our friendship on the improbability that it could become something more. Love meant something different to Bee than it did to me. She fell hard and fast for crushes, like tripping face first on pavement. My feelings were a slow, sinking sort of love, like easing into a hot bath that leaves you dizzy and slack. If I let myself sink in further, I would never come out again. I couldn't allow any more space to that unruly feeling. I had to be okay with the fact that Bee didn't feel the same way about me. That night, I lay with my arms and legs stiff against me, while Bee flopped around in the bed beside me. Her fingers twitched against my arm when she dreamed. Everything had changed for me. but nothing had changed for B. After that, I didn't let myself wish for anything when it came to B. Except one thing. I wish I could love her even a little bit less.
And that was Parisa Akbari reading from Just Another Epic Love Poem. Parisa, how long did you work on this book?
You know, the first draft, I would say in total, maybe took about 5 months. But the editorial process, we spent a long time looking at the structure of different poems and kind of examining how to balance the prose, the poetry, the never-ending poem, the other ephemera like text messages and emails and letters. So probably 4 years from the start of formulating the idea until it was published.
And this is your first published novel?
Yeah.
Now, had you published other types of work before?
Only poetry, essays, and short things like that in small literary journals. This was my first big undertaking.
Did you always want to be a writer?
I did, yeah. I remember growing up, I really enjoyed a lot of the early like chapter books in middle grade. And I remember when I got to the young adult genre, when I was in high school, reading some Sarah Dessen and thinking, oh, wouldn't it be amazing to get to just tell stories like this that have such an impact on someone.
Now, in your acknowledgments, you write about someone sending you a cartoon that inspired you. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah. When COVID had just started to really take hold, I think it was like April of 2020, one of my best friends sent me this screenshot of a cartoon from The New Yorker. And it's this picture of a guy in this torrential storm in a canoe on super choppy waters, and he's missing a paddle. His boat has a hole in it. He's got piranhas and sharks circling around him, and it's just a disaster. And the thought bubble above his head read something like, ah, now is the perfect time to finish that novel. And I remember my friend texting it to me and saying, that's you, isn't it? Because everybody had headed into lockdown, this tremendously traumatic time, especially for folks in the mental health field. There was a lot that we were holding and making space for our clients and folks that we worked with. And then also having this thought that, oh, now I have all this free time. I should start baking bread or writing this novel or whatever it may be. And so it was definitely ironic, but true in some way, that in that really chaotic time, this was my way of processing some different emotions and making space for my own narrative while I also held space for the folks that I work with.
Now, you had already been working on the novel previously to that, right?
Just a little bit. I think I started in January 2020.
Oh, wow. Okay. And you go on to say, that a dedicated and creative team came together to help you bring Mitra and B's story onto these pages. So who was part of your team and what role did they play?
I didn't realize before getting to this stage just how many folks are involved in the process of publishing a book and how specialized each of their roles can be. So first, I had the partnership with my literary agent, Curisa Robinson, who is a real advocate for her authors and just helps nurture the career and also try to get the very best possible deals for the folks that she represents. And then I got to work with some different editors who had a real vision that they shared with me for the book. And so even as they made recommendations to restructure or rewrite things, I could see that they had that same heart in mind. And so I really trusted where they were taking me on the process. So that included Lainey Davis, and that included Ellen Cormier at Penguin Books for Young Readers. Dial is the imprint, and their editorial assistant, Squish Pruitt, as well, gave a lot of really helpful feedback. And then you get to the part where people are copy editing, proofreading, designing the text, designing the cover, and helping you get the message out into the world through publicity and marketing. And everybody in every step along the way, I could see that they wanted to connect this book to readers and make sure the right people found it and make sure that it could be the best story it could be. So I have a real appreciation now for how that whole team comes together and the way that that made me feel less isolated and less alone in the creative process.
Now, I've often been told that finding an agent is one of the hardest parts. It can be even more difficult than finding a publisher. How did you find your agent?
Originally, I had written a different novel that I wanted to pitch to literary agents. And with that novel, I started the query process probably in spring of 2018. And I had been influenced by a lot of the stuff happening politically and feeling like I wanted to have some sense of being able to tell hopeful stories for young readers. So that propelled me to get serious about it. And I was lucky that I think I sent out maybe 7 query letters, and Curisa was my top choice. And I was so fortunate that she really connected with that story. And then the hard part for me, the challenge for me was I felt like, wow, I can't believe I got this literary agent so quickly. And then we really struggled to try to shop that novel around and find a publishing home for it. And feeling like, oh, I made it through the first hurdle, but the next hurdle, I felt stumped. And so being able to take a step back and start a new project, which became Just Another Epic Love Poem, was really helpful for me. But just to say that if people find that they're running up against obstacles or rejections, that is absolutely part of the process. And maybe your rejections are happening at the agenting stage, or maybe at the publishing stage, or maybe both. But oftentimes we only hear the stories of these like instant overnight sensations, and people think, oh, it should just take a week and everybody should be clambering for this book. And sometimes it happens like that, but sometimes that is the person's fourth book or fifth book. Or sometimes it was a year of seeking an agent or a publisher. So just to know that I think the strongest skill you can have to survive in publishing is that persistence.
Absolutely. So that first book, what will you revisit that at some point? Or is that the one that goes in the drawer never to be seen again?
I hope to revisit it. I wrote a few other practice novels before that one to work on craft, to kind of understand my storytelling perspective. And so I would love to revisit that one, because that was the first that I wrote with a serious hope of publishing it. And I think the thing that I'm most nostalgic for about that story is that it was a disabled narrative. And so whether or not I ever publish that book, I am eager to get into writing disabled characters again. And that's something I'm going to try to focus on in my next project if I can.
What do you think made Just Another Epic Love Poem more successful in the marketplace than your first novel?
I think that it had a unique concept in the sense that there was this through line of never-ending poetry. And I think publishing houses were interested in the combination of how would a story work when it's told both through prose and through this conversational poem. I think that even though my style tends to be pretty character driven and less like big splashy plot and exciting hook, which is generally more marketable, that something like a Throughline of Poetry adds a bit of a twist that can get readers and publishing houses a little more interested in, like, oh, how is that going to look? And what will it, how will the story unfold? And how is the poem going to shape the narrative? So I think that helped create a bit of a buzz around the book.
Now, what I was curious about was, as you were writing, did you write a little bit of prose, a little bit of poetry, go back and forth? Or were you more, you write the whole prose book and then fill in the poetry, or write the whole poem and then write the story around it?
I started with writing a prose section and then writing the poem that would go with it. But toward the middle of the book, I got really invested in post-it notes. I just started to find that because there's so many breakouts in this novel, it's just snippets of prose, but then snippets of the never-ending poem, and then also poetry that Mitra does for her assignments in class, and, you know, text messages from other people. So I started to feel that I could write the emotional beat of the moment on a post-it note and kind of outline in that way, and then decide what's going to convey that emotional beat in the best way. Is it going to be a snippet of never-ending poem that Mitra writes? Is it going to be a poem that she writes for her poetry seminar journal? Is it going to be prose that unfolds in kind of a traditional way? Is it going to be a thread of text messages between her and another character? And so that enabled me to look at how the connective tissue of the story could come together and also carry those beats of the story in the best way. So by the midpoint, I was kind of more like quilting things together.
Did you know from the beginning where the story was going?
I, at the beginning, did not expect that this would be a romance.
Okay.
I'll try to talk about this without giving spoilers for the current book as it exists. But I thought of it as more of a heartbreak story. Mm. And I think over time, that shifted. And, you know, it's not a traditional romance in the sense that I think a lot of romance novels follow a certain trajectory. And this is a little different. There is quite a bit more coming of age and family relationships that are a part of the story. And also the timeline maybe is a little different to a traditional romance, in that in a traditional romance, characters fall in love, you know, at this beat in the story. Things look a little different here. But it is much closer to a romance than I thought it would be at the beginning. And I think what changed was a conversation with myself and my editor and agent about what would be hopeful and optimistic for young people right now, and what might really convey the message I wanted to get across, which is that vulnerability can feel like a risky thing, but it's also a thing that brings you closer to your connections with other people. So I'm happy with where we ended up.
Oh, good. How did you know when the book was done? You said there was a lot of editing that went into it. How did you know when, okay, we'll put a pin in it, this is it?
Well, typically with a traditional publisher, you might do kind of like 2 to 3 rounds of revisions from a developmental perspective. And then you do the nitty gritty, like copy editing, word choice, things like that. So I knew in the sense that I had a deadline and that I knew where we were in the process of like, okay, now we're in the second draft, now we're in the third draft. But also I think at a certain point, I just zoomed out and was like, oh, this story is what it needs to be. And now I'm not trying to find a new way to tell it anymore. I'm just trying to polish it and to let it shine. And so that was a great shift when you move from the developmental perspective of like, how are you going to tell the story, toward, let's just now make sure that it's shining. That was an interesting moment to really zoom out and see, I've made it there.
Wow. So what's next for you in your writing career?
Immediately next, I have just some fun events coming up. I'm headed to Pittsburgh for the Greater Pittsburgh Festival of Books on May 11th. If there's anybody who is in the Pittsburgh area, I hope to see you there. And then I'm heading to a writer in residence at a place called Hedgebrook here in Washington, where you can have some dedicated time in nature to just get a bunch of writing done and meet other writers. So I'm looking forward to starting a next project there. And yeah, you can expect more YA from me, probably more exploratory stuff in terms of playing with the form of the way that novels are written, and more queer love stories, and hopefully as well some disabled narratives as well.
And do you see yourself as a full-time writer in the future?
At the moment, I'm really happy with the balance that I have between mental health therapy and writing. I think that it kind of feeds two different parts of myself, that I get to feel connected to other people and to serve other people in this way. But then I also get to connect to my own creativity and my own stories. So at the moment, I am happy with that. I think that that could always change. But right now, I really enjoy being able to explore these two parts of myself in these two different roles.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Parisa. This has been a really lovely conversation. And we always close with the quote. And of course, you quote in your book, Rumi, who is a Persian poet that probably everybody in the world has heard about. And so I found a good quote from Rumi that I think is fitting. In your light, I learn how to love. In your beauty, how to make poems. You dance inside my chest where no one sees you, but sometimes I do, and that sight becomes this art.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for having me, Monica.
Thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.